All right, good afternoon. This is Christian Tirado with the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program at the J. Wayne Wrights Union at the University of Florida of Gainesville, Florida. Today is the 27th of March of 2017, and I'm joined by Diana Moreno, the Assistant Director of MCDA. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak with you today, and we're going to start off by introducing yourself and by stating and spelling your full name.
Sure, yeah, thank you for having me. My name is Diana Moreno. As Christian said, I'm the Assistant Director of Multicultural and Diversity Affairs. My name is spelled D-I-A-N-A-M-O-R-E-N-O.
Also, I would ask, where were you born and when were you born?
Sure. I was born in Quito, in Ecuador, and my date of birth is August 26, 1987.
Okay, perfect. Also, if I may, to dictate the name of your mother and father, and when and where were they born as well?
So my mom is Monica Patricia Moreno. She was also born in Quito, Ecuador, on the 14th of November of 1961. And my dad, Galo Moreno, was born in Quito as well on July 21st, 1959.
All right, perfect. Yeah. So I did want to start this interview by discussing your early life and what shaped and molded you to become the person that you are today. So is there any, you know, if there's any point that you wanted to start with your early life in Quito, as you said, in Ecuador, how was your childhood like? How was being raised in a family, in a Latin American family like?
Yeah, definitely. My background, my family background in Quito, I would say, was really very fortunate. I come from a family, both from my mom and my dad's side of the family, full of a lot of rich characters. My dad is one of nine children. My mom is one of seven. So definitely large families, pretty close-knit, especially in my mom's side. Both of my family backgrounds were really from working class backgrounds. So my father was raised by really a single mom because his parents were divorced. And I love the history of my grandmother, Adela Moreno, who was actually divorced at a time where divorce was so rare for women of her generation. But also I never got to meet her, but I always heard stories of her having such a strong character and, you know, having to raise nine children by herself, I imagine, built some of that. But, what I learned is that she became, I don't remember the name of that particular profession, but she was like a typist, like a court typist. I don't know, you know what I'm talking about? Yeah. And she actually moved up in the ranks, working in the government offices until she actually became one of the official typists for a president of Ecuador. Uh-huh. So she actually worked for President Ibarra. Mm-hmm. Which is something that, you know, I found out later in my childhood, and I thought that was really awesome and something to be proud of. Because she was able to make it through the help of her oldest daughter, who's like a second mom to my dad, Yola, who pretty much also like raised her youngest siblings, and then the help of like other family friends or people that she was able to employ through her work. So I feel like through her, I'm sort of continuing a line of like independent working women. And then really the person in my mother's side that I look up to the most and was my inspiration was my grandfather, mi abuelo Miguel, who was also the breadwinner in his side of the family with seven children to take care of. And he really came from poverty. He was from the sort of rural part of Ecuador around San Pablo, which is in the highlands. And I remember always hearing stories of his father, because his mother died when he was a baby, when he was young, and his father had to pretty much have him stop going to school because he needed an extra hand in like the fields, because they were farm workers. And so my grandpa, I don't think, went to school past I think fifth grade. And I remember him saying that the first pair of shoes he ever owned were actually when he joined the Ecuadorian military, and they gave him like his pair of shoes at the age of 17, like his first pair of shoes. And so like he definitely came from like humble beginnings, and I really admired his work ethic, but also he always had a passion for justice, for social justice, and so I always remember talking with him around the kitchen table about, you know, issues facing the country, or like overhearing him talk about retiree rights and, you know, how the government was taking away retiree pensions. And later I found out that he actually was a really active member of his union, the bus driver's union, because he used to be a bus driver. And as somebody who's interested in labor issues and has always been interested in labor rights and workers' rights, that just felt like it was something that was in my blood. So so really those are my lineage that I really value and honor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. No, it's a beautiful story. I think, if I may, a lot of your childhood was defined by this admiration of your lineage, of these working class individuals, and as you say, you know, these independent working class women that you had the opportunity to really see. So, you know, moving from there to what would then become your life outside of Ecuador, how do you feel that those working, that the working class ancestry, and that you know, this righteous sacrifice for those that you also consider your family, motivated, or what became a deciding factor in your move from Ecuador to the United States, or also, you know, in a more general question, a more general sense, what were the reasons for your move from Ecuador to the United States?
Yeah.
When did that occur?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, following on my grandparents' footsteps, both of my parents were really hard workers. My mom started working when she was 15. She started helping out at a doctor's office, and she eventually became like a doctor's assistant who became like my family doctor for my entire life, Dr. Bonilla. I still remember his name. And so she has worked since she was younger. Eventually she became a teacher, and that's how I knew my mother. That was her identity. Her professional identity was always as a teacher. And I remember to this day, you know, her with grading paper sprawled all over the bed, and me and my sister helping her grade and things like that. And my father has always been an entrepreneur, even though he did actually go to college, and he studied childhood development in college in Ecuador. He was always disillusioned, I think, by the system in Ecuador, that I don't think it ever gave him what he expected. He's an ambitious man, and he always was disappointed in what he saw as a system that was inadequate and corrupt and inefficient. And I think that's why he gave up on his degree, his medical degree, because he, you know, I remember being really sad when he told me, you know, I realized after getting my degree in childhood development and working with, he worked with developmentally challenged children. Mm-hmm. And he said, I made more money driving the bus for the school that I work for than actually being their teacher. Mm-hmm. And so he felt like it was so unfair that a society worked in this way, where, like, you know, a teacher of developmentally disabled children were not paid. They were paid pennies. They were paid nothing. And so he actually, you know, moved on to pretty much hustle, right? So, like, he drove a bus and he owned different businesses. Eventually he came to own, like, this auto parts business, where one of his business partners actually scammed him out of a lot of money. And this really, really huge disappointment, and like the lack of regulations or like ability for him to get his money back, because of, like, you know, law enforcement was not really helpful and things like that, coupled with other larger systems in Ecuador, like there was like a huge financial crisis in Ecuador in the late 90s, where my grandfather lost a lot of his pension, a bunch of people lost a lot of their savings, It was pretty much sort of like a perfect storm that made my parents decide to try their luck in the States. And this was actually a decision that they came to make because one of my mother's friends of the family, she was actually her colleague, a teacher friend, was a U.S. citizen from Ecuadorian descent, but she was a U.S. citizen and she was moving back to the United States and pretty much asked my mom, if you're interested, like you have a place to stay if you wanted to come. And that's how the decision was made more easy for us, because we had people we knew, because otherwise we didn't know anybody here. Mm-hmm. And that was the catalyst for them deciding, when my sister was 14 years old, I think in like ninth grade, I was 11, I was finishing sixth grade, and the plan was to be here for a couple years until they saved up enough money to go back.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, you speak of this life of disillusionment that happened with your family while in Ecuador, and you say that this plus other like macro systemic issues within Ecuador, you know, a country mired by like economic crises in the 80s and 90s, led to that migration to the United States. You know, I'm sure that at the age of 11 that you had become very much accustomed to life in Ecuador, right? And now being in this new country with its new customs and culture was definitely a shock to you and to many in your family. How would you explain that acclimation that you felt when you came to the United States and the difficulties that you faced as you then had to, you know, exist being a young child all the way until their young adulthood and their future essentially in the United States?
Yeah, well, that was really difficult because as someone who grew up outside of the United States, we in the world outside of the United States know about life in the United States through the media, through movies, through I would call it cultural imperialism in a way, mm-hmm. the way that other parts of the world really are almost forced to know about what's going on here, and we're certainly, even as children, pretty familiar with U.S. culture. And of course, that was me. I grew up watching Disney movies. I grew up watching Full House and Friends and Clarissa Explains It All. And I thought that that's what I would be coming into. I really thought that I was really excited as a child because, you know, this is where those amazing like movies and shows came from. I figured that that's the way society also operated. And I was honestly super disappointed that that's not what I actually lived, because coming from Quito, a capital city full of culture, full of diverse people, you know, even though most people in Ecuador are mestizo, but it was still like a diverse, rich culture. I moved to Lakeland, Florida, which is a pretty small town in central Florida, pretty homogenous, pretty segregated, pretty conservative. And those aren't even words that I could articulate as an 11-year-old. You just kind of like, you know, live whatever is around you. And another big shock is like pretty much not knowing how to deal with the fact that we went from like being like a working class to middle class family in Ecuador to starting from the bottom here. Like our class changed, and that was painful for me because as a 11-year-old, as a sort of preteen, you start developing your sense of self and you start really caring about those things, and especially as a new person in middle school, which is already super awkward, mm-hmm. I think that the shock of, first of all, the place where we lived is not living up to my expectations at all. And seeing my family really struggle, seeing my parents, who, again, both were professional in Ecuador, start having to start from scratch, working as a hotel room, a housekeeper with my mom or my dad. He worked for like a landscaping company, you know, manual labor that I'd never, ever seen them do in my life. So that was just a really, I mean, it took me for a spin. It was a huge challenge to my sense of self and to my sense of my family. And it was difficult. It was really difficult because as a young kid in Ecuador, I mean, I went to private school. I was president of my class. I was one of the top students in my class. And that was another thing that was shocking, is that going to public school in the United States, I felt that my teachers and my peers didn't see me as who I knew I was. They didn't see me as smart. Mm-hmm. They didn't see, you know, they just heard my accent. They just saw the color of my skin. They just assumed that I was from Mexico. And like, I remember, you know, people asking me like, did you come here on a boat? Mm-hmm. Did you swim here? Like things that, you know, looking back on are horrible, like racist remarks. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really even understand what they meant. I didn't understand like where that was coming from. I was like, what do you mean? I came here on an airplane, you know? And so those are painful memories, but also, you know, they are the immigrant story. They are now part of my identity and something that I take pride in, because there's no bigger challenge to overcome as a young kid that will really like humble you. Because for me, as a young kid in Ecuador, you know, I had a pretty good life. I wasn't a very humble, and pretty quickly I became humble, right, in my new home.
So I mean, you know, having grown up to be an educator of young adults here at the University of Florida, you know, I always, you know, I listen to your story. You speak about how education and public schooling, as well as the environment in education, your relationship with teachers and with other students, really shaped, or, you know, to a certain degree, shaped who you were. What are the difficulties that you faced, you know, while you were going through the school system and trying to navigate not only how you can succeed professionally and academically, but also as you went on this journey to find yourself in this new country?
Yeah. I think it's almost ironic that now my job is really to empower students to accept and love their identities and to build power through their identities, because I think part of the reason I'm so passionate about my current position is because the opposite was my experience in the public school system here in the United States. I think that as a method of social survival, young students learn, especially if you possess identities that are marginalized, as a method of survival, you learn to hide those identities, or you learn to hate those identities. You learn that those identities, if celebrated, are punished in the system. And so, for example, if I was conditioned not to want to speak Spanish in my school, because I was one of like two or three Hispanic Latino students, and I was conditioned to not even want to hang out with the small number of Hispanic Latino students and build community with them, because it was very clear to me that that was a group of like lower social standing. And as a kid who came from being a popular kid in my elementary school, like, I wanted to hang out with the popular kids. Like, I thought, like, well, that's the group that I belong in. That's my social class. So what I saw in the United States is that the popular kids were white. The popular kids were wealthy. And that's what I strive towards, unconsciously, towards becoming. And it's something that, again, I look back on a little bit painfully, because what it led to for me to do was to whitewash myself. And that included, you know, trying to dress in a certain way, listen to a certain music, I rejected some of, you know, the music that my parents listened to. I was not interested in listening to, you know, Latin music. I wasn't interested in looking back. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just look forward. And I think it really wasn't until college, it really wasn't until my undergrad and really solidified in my graduate school years where I was able to take that back. I was able to really explore my identity as a Latina and embrace it, mm-hmm. really embrace it. And
you know, I would only want to go more in depth as to how an individual, you know, who comes from another country is almost stripped from certain parts of their culture as they do enter the schooling system here in the United States. But also, you know, your journey as you enter your undergraduate years here at UF and then your graduate years at UF, as to how you were able to reclaim that back. So I'm sure you faced that there were certain difficulties that you faced, or as you've explained, while you were young and you were going through you know, primary and secondary schooling. But then what starts going on through your mind as you realize that you are a first generation college student within the United States at the University of Florida? And what was going through your mind when you enter the campus, and mm-hmm. I mean, did you really expect the experiences that you came to engage in your first year, and then, you know, yeah. moving forward?
Well, first of all, I should say that I started my college journey in community college. Okay. Because it was really a financial decision, most of all, considering I was undocumented whenever I graduated high school. And so going to a four-year college would have meant applying as an international student, and that just wasn't feasible for me. And so I started at Santa Fe College. That in itself felt like sort of selling myself short in a way, even though I do think that I got a really great education at Santa Fe. I feel like in the back of my head, I always knew that I could do better, mm-hmm. you know? And so it kind of continued this disappointment in like the opportunities that were afforded to me here, because I knew that I was smart and that I could have gone to four-year college directly, but I wasn't able to afford it because of circumstances, right? And so that in itself, I think, led for my college career to be different. You know, starting off at Santa Fe and feeling a little bit disconnected. I didn't get really that involved at Santa Fe. I think that this is something that I've had to battle my entire life, is sort of that idea that, you know, I almost give up the good because I think that I deserve the perfect in a way. And so I feel like I gave up in like and attempting to get involved in Santa Fe because I felt internally that it wasn't good enough for me, but I really should have. Mm-hmm. Looking back, I think like I really, really should have not been afraid to make the best out of my situation. Then when I was able to get into UF in 2009, I started here as a junior, and I did feel like a little bit of a fish out of water because this is such a huge school, and students already seem like they know exactly what they're doing with themselves, and they have their group of friends already formed, and so there was another sort of like challenge for me to really feel like I belonged. But I remember actually finding some sense of community when I actually saw a group of students protesting, and I asked what they were protesting for, and they were protesting for farm worker rights, and I remember just kind of being shocked because I was like, wow, this is like a group of mostly white students protesting on behalf of people who look like me, mm-hmm. and people who like don't have a lot of privilege. And so I thought that was really, really great. So I decided to like join them. And so that's how I joined like Student Farm Worker Alliance, which is a student group that was really active back then. I got involved a little bit in like Chispas. I got involved in Students for a Democratic Society, because throughout my my life, I've always been interested in like social justice issues and political issues, and so that felt like a really fitting for me. And that's really where I found community here as an undergrad. It was really in activism, and students who share that passion for like social justice is really where I feel like that was my first community as a college student. It was my activist friends.
Good. So yeah, I mean, you know, you mentioned that there were certain difficulties with getting involved in Santa Fe, and that's only entirely understandable, as anyone who enters college knows the difficulties of that. But also, you know, you were saying that there were certain struggles that you faced when you entered UF, but at the same time, you were afforded certain opportunities to get involved with the community and get involved with social justice work and social activism. Do you ever feel that, although you may have had similar ideological leanings as the individuals in those organizations, that you were still marginalized within those organizations? You feel at any point that your voice wasn't heard due to, you know, your sex, gender, or ethnic background, or anything of that sort?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question, and the answer is yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's almost one of the, in sort of the journey of figuring out where I fit in, there's many disappointments in that, and that's normal. But I remember one of the biggest for me was feeling silenced or just feeling a little bit overlooked in a lot of the meetings that were held, for example, in Students for a Democratic Society, where it was a male-dominated space. And it felt like it was only like three or four of the same people who made all the decisions, and I didn't really feel heard. And I challenged that, I remember, after one of my suggestions was shut down. And then because the suggestion was shut down, we actually ended up having an issue at an event that my suggestion would have made better. Mm-hmm. And in the post-event meeting, I remember saying like, this is something that I brought up and I was ignored, and then we had the issue, we had a problem, and it was because we were trying to work with another group that people had a problem with, and I was like, well, we need to have a pre-meeting with them to make sure that we're on the same page, and I was ignored. But then we ended up having a problem with this organization, and so I remember bringing that up and saying like, you know, really pointing out like we're not modeling the equity and the social justice that we say that we espouse. And I feel like that was one of the first times that I became really disillusioned and realized, you know, like even in social justice or progressive spaces, there's going to be issues. Mm-hmm. And it actually led me to get involved in feminist organizing, where, you know, I felt like I wouldn't be facing those same obstacles.
Right. So, yeah, for many students here at the University of Florida, you know, my experiences with speaking with them is that they have, when entering those organizations, they have felt similar to how you felt in when you did so the same, right? And one of the responses that they have to this sort of marginalization within ideologically similar or spaces, right? Spaces where they share the same ideas, is that they then resign themselves from those organizations and enter organizations that very much like reflect their ethnic backgrounds, right? So did you ever find yourself doing that or being attracted to that idea, but then ultimately not acting upon that? Or how was your relationship with maybe, you know, the existing cultural organizations here on campus during that time?
So that's actually a really good question, and I didn't really ever during undergrad get involved in student organizations or other organizations that were specific to my Hispanic Latinx backgrounds. And I think that the reason is there's a couple of reasons for that. First, I thought that everybody already had their group figured out, and I couldn't come in to belong in these groups because they were already formed. But also, looking back on it, I come to reflect that because when I moved to the United States, I moved to a predominantly white town and a predominantly white school. I had mostly white friends, and I feel like that's almost what I became used to. Even though I know that I craved community, and I craved having friends who I could relate to in cultural ways that my white friends could never relate to me as. I really didn't know how to make those friends. I just didn't know. It was one of those things that where I never really had the opportunity to be in a community of Hispanic Latinx students up until honestly my graduate school years. And I think that the reason I never pursued that in undergrad is because I didn't know how, and I didn't really see any openings or had people to guide me to those spaces. And so unfortunately, where I found sort of my affinity group was in feminist organizing and in sort of, spaces that were centered in the experiences of folks who identify as women. But even that, you know, looking back, it wasn't enough because as a woman of color, my experience is specific and unlike, for example, white women. And so I continued on my journey after that.
Right. I think one of the themes of this this semester's projects are that there are certain issues that do face African American and Latino students here within this campus, and that although 8 years have passed since you first entered the University of Florida, many of the students still feel the same way. That although they may enter these spaces that share these same ideas, they may not feel as if their voice is completely heard, and for many of them, they then either enter culturally homogenous places or places that are much more open to their backgrounds that they were either born with or that they have been socialized to associate themselves with. So, you know, along those same lines, was there ever a moment in your time here at the University of Florida that you felt that you had to leave, or that you needed a break, or how are the moments where you were able to leave UF and go back home with family? How did those moments, how did those moments feel?
So the funny thing is, because I have been socialized to, or I had been socialized to, really separate my family life from my school life, since middle school, it felt sort of like a continuation of what I've been always been doing all my life. So home was always sort of like a bubble for me. It was a comfort zone for me. And unfortunately, my friend's life and my family life really rarely merged in my life here in the United States until much later. And the reason is because, again, the cultural divide within my family and my friends was really big. And also, there was some shame that I carried because of the class differences between my family and my friends' families, between the fact that my parents couldn't speak English and you know, I wasn't going to have my parents' friends meet my parents because I was embarrassed that my parents didn't speak English. And I didn't have any Hispanic Latinx friends, so it was really difficult to navigate that as a child, but it's something that you get used to, right? So I just got used to separating my life between my friends and my family, and only my closest friends like knew my parents, and my parents just accepted it because again they didn't know anything else either, right? So we had moved to a place where they still live, and they made such a big change moving from Ecuador to the United States that in a lot of occasions I've tried to convince my parents to really like move somewhere more diverse, but like it seems to them that like one big change was enough, you know, and so they choose to remain in Lakeland, and they have built a small little community there of people that they know and trust. But for me, it always felt like way too homogenous, way too white, way too conservative. And Gainesville felt like a step up, to be honest, in terms of diversity. But yeah, so in college, it just felt like, you know, going back home was going back to my little bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, you speak about this almost dual life that you held, you know, if I may. At least, you know, that's what the experiences are of many students of color here at the University of Florida, which is that their family life is very much different than the life that they hold at university, but they're expected to maintain both, you know, both of those relationships, and that becomes difficult to juggle. So, you know, I'll ask in more explicit terms, but due to your sex, your gender, your ethnic background, did you feel that hindered at moments your performance here at the University of Florida that may have not hindered other students' experiences?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no starker example than the fact that in Ecuador, I attended not just a private school, but it was an all-girls school. And it was mostly made up of children from my ethnic and racial background and from my same gender and from a similar class background. And so in this environment in Ecuador, I thrived. I thrived as a student. I thrived as a leader. You know, I mean, I was only there for 6 years from first through sixth grade, but, you know, I was a top student in my class. I was, like, really involved in my school. I remember, like, my mom was always really proud because, like, the principal asked me to give a speech because they thought that I was good at public speaking or whatever. You know, little things like that, right? So, obviously, like, my intellectual and social abilities have been good since I was a kid, but they were so developmentally almost stopped when I entered middle school and really throughout, because I didn't see myself in my peers. I didn't see myself in my teachers. I never felt that my experiences and my identity was welcomed or embraced or honored or celebrated. Mm-hmm. It was something to hide. Mm-hmm. And it's so detrimental to students. And so I think that's part of the reason, because I experienced it personally. That's part of the reason why I'm really passionate about offering a different type of environment for the students that I work with, because it really is so detrimental to one's sense of self but also like one's even academic performance, because I spent a lot of time as a, you know, high school student, as an undergrad, worrying about things that I shouldn't have been worrying about. So, like, you know, my social, how I look to other people, or, you know, just worrying about so many things. And of course, you know, teenagers worry about that. All undergraduates worry about that. But I think that the way that it impacts, especially marginalized students, like sense of self and sense of belonging, and how that impacts their performance in a classroom, it's very real. It has real impact.
Right. For sure. For sure. And, you know, and although you faced all of these difficulties and all these times of uncertainty at the University of Florida, and all the unique challenges that a student of color will face in a university setting, you still decided, you know, to summon what was best in you and to continue your academic development at the University of Florida for a master's degree. So, what led you to such a decision, and then why did you want to stay here at UF?
Yeah. The decision was pretty pragmatic. I remember just thinking to myself, after having graduated from undergrad, you know, I was like, I don't really know what I want to do with my life. I felt a little bit at a loss. I eventually had the opportunity to become a labor organizer, and I enjoyed that experience, but I knew that it wasn't necessarily what I fully wanted to do, and it wasn't even like a permanent position. It was a temporary position, so there wasn't really a future in that. So I felt like it was pragmatic because I knew that as a woman of color, I already had enough consciousness to know that as a woman of color, I probably needed a master's degree to have a job that paid a living wage. And so that's really the reason I decided to go back to school. It was because I thought that this degree would afford me a decent life. But I decided to study Latin American studies because I was already sort of in this journey of like trying to find a way back to myself. Like I was really interested in exploring that part of my identity because it had been sort of silenced for so long. And that's the reason I chose Latin American studies. And again, you know, being a pragmatist, I think really has to do with my cultural background because we can't really afford to like dream big in a way. Like it's kind of sad to say it that way, but I think that the United States mentality is like, oh, you know, just go for like the best school, study wherever there's the best program, or you know, it's like reach for the stars, you know. But really, like in my family, it's like, okay, go for what you can go for. And also go where it's close to home, because family's close. If I told my parents that I was thinking of moving to New York, and they're like, "Are you kidding me? Like, no, please don't." You know, even though they've always allowed me a certain level of independence, but for me, University of Florida, you know, it's a good school. They have a good Latin American Studies program. It was like a pretty pragmatic decision that aligned with my academic interest at the time.
And for those of you who are like not familiar with the Center for Latin American Studies that we have here, it's one of the best, right, I believe, in the country, and it remains as such. And in my experiences, and you know, I'll interject here, but in my experience with the Latin American Studies department, it is definitely an environment that is very much different than the rest of the University of Florida. So you will see a lot of professors, understandably, that have Latino backgrounds, and you will see classrooms for the first time here at the University of Florida that have a majority of students of color, and specifically, you know, Latinos, Latinas, and Latinx students, right? So as you become a graduate student and you're surrounded in a slightly different environment, did that shape how you saw UF, or did that make your academic success easier? And maybe explain as to what the center was able to offer you that the general UF wasn't able to.
Yeah, so I think, first of all, I was more mature. When I started grad school, I was 26, right? Mm-hmm. And so I had already had experience in the professional world. I had worked in Sarasota as a human rights monitor, having worked with the Fair Food Standards Council there. I had already worked as a labor organizer for United Faculty of Florida, so I was also hyper aware of higher education as a system, right, from the faculty's point of view, and that gave me a different perspective of coming back to higher education with that knowledge. But also, I think that a master's in Latin American Studies, that particular program, was one of the first programs that, or one of the first times that my lived experience was actually a asset, right? It wasn't a detriment. It wasn't something to hide. It was something to actually promote. It was like my experience as an immigrant, somebody who grew up in Ecuador, somebody who has interest in social justice and has worked with farm workers, that was actually like a good thing, right? And so ever since the beginning, that was embraced and seen as something positive, which I think really helped me develop. And I feel like I found my sort of like passionate nerdy self again, right? Because I felt like my intellect and my lived experiences were really valued in that space. And I also had a really wonderful cohort of students who were also passionate and also shared a lot of my identities. So I became closest to two women from immigrant backgrounds, one of them from the Dominican Republic and one of them from Chile, but we the three of us became really close, and I think that speaks a lot to, you know, how those lived experiences, sharing those lived experiences really is empowering and can lead to the building of community.
Yes, definitely. And, you know, from there, you move on to, at least to my knowledge, your experiences entering the Institute for Hispanic and Latino Cultures. And so using the experiences that you have had, you know, that you've explained thus far from your early life to your time here at UF and your undergrad years and your graduate years, what shaped your decision to enter the Institute of Hispanic Latino Cultures at the time and to really jump into a department that seeks to empower the most marginalized of this campus? And what did you feel that your purpose was here in that position?
Well, first I just want to speak a little about like my journey in my master's program, which I think is really telling, because it ended up being, my concentration became Latino studies, but it started out as development studies. So my concentration was development studies because I wanted to study Ecuador. Again, with this idea of like, sort of like going back to exploring myself and my identity, I thought, well, I have to start at home. I have to start in Ecuador. And so I wanted to study the Ecuadorian political system. But after taking classes and after seeing what I really became passionate about, I realized that my identity is now beyond my Ecuadorian identity. As I really came to see myself as a Latina for the first time really in graduate school, because even though like I identified as a Latina before and I knew that was part of who I was, I always identified with my sort of Ecuadorian roots, and almost came to reject a lot of sort of like I came to reject the idea that I was Americanized, right? Like I was always Ecuadorian. But really, through learning what it means to be a Latina in graduate school, really learning like that sort of like new identity of an immigrant that makes you a Latina, I realized like that's actually who I am. Like that's my identity. I can no longer afford to ignore the fact that my journey has taken me to this country, whether it was through my own decision or not. And really, I came to decide to get my master's in Latino studies. Mm-hmm. And so through that journey of self-discovery and academic discovery, when I was exposed to the opportunity to become the program coordinator of Hispanic Latino Affairs, it really seemed to fit right where my academic journey led me to. And it was a really great opportunity that I saw. As somebody who wanted to stay in Gainesville because I have family here, by that time I was already married to my partner, so I decided to pursue that opportunity and thankfully got it.
Yes, of course. And so using the experiences and the issues that you did see going through UF and certain struggles that you faced, I'm sure that although your position may have outlined a specific set of responsibilities and duties that you needed to accomplish for the IHLC at the moment, I'm sure you also had a larger vision for your position. Then now you are no longer a student, but you serve as a person of authority, an educator of sorts to these young students coming in through La Casita, as it's known colloquially. So how did you want to use that position as programs coordinator to make the experiences of Latino students better or empower them to have a better time here at UF that, you know, you may have had difficulties embracing while you were a student?
Well, first of all, I would have to say that it was a the first year was a learning opportunity for me, because I may have come in with some ideas of what it is that I could provide for students. My initial instinct was to give students what I didn't have, which is like this welcoming and safe space for Hispanic Latino students specifically. You know, I always have a soft spot for first generation students and those who come from communities where they haven't really found their Latinx home yet. Mm. But what I found is that, like, I cannot recreate this paternalistic sort of savior mentality of, like, you know, I will be the staff person who, you know, saves the students from this world of isolation mm-hmm. in a predominantly white institution. Like, I really came to learn that what I have to do first and foremost is to listen to my students and to learn from them what they need, because the last thing that you need as someone who belongs to a marginalized community is for people to peg you as something, for people to assume where you belong or what you need. And I think that I had to really check myself and understand that, you know, yes, I may know about one particular aspect of a journey of a immigrant student, a Latino student, but I don't know all journeys. Mm-hmm. Our community is so diverse within itself that I had to learn that as well. Mm-hmm. I had to learn about my students who come from Miami and who are very much used to a large Hispanic Latinx community and are very much used to feeling very comfortable speaking Spanglish and you know, having a café con leche and listening to their salsa, their bachata. They don't care. Unlike me, who at some point in my life was ashamed of that identity, they are very much ready to celebrate that identity. They just need the space. But there are the other students who, again, come in from smaller towns or come in from places where they didn't feel like they could celebrate that. And so I just really learned that my first job as a new staff person was to listen to those students. But I think that in and of itself can be empowering to students when they'll have somebody who will listen to them.
Mm-hmm. So you would say that the most... That the most useful or the best skill that an individual who works with students could have is listening, or being an active listener and listening to their concerns and what they want from, you know, what is essentially the student affairs department.
For sure. I think that creating a space not just to support students, but also when it's necessary and appropriate to challenge them, right? So that's another thing that I feel like I learned. 'Cause part of me wanted to just hold space for students and be there for them all the time. And then I realized, like, I'm doing them a disservice if all I do is tell them, like, oh, everything you're doing is great. Like, all, you know, like, if all you do is support them without challenging them, then they're not really going to grow.
Of course.
And that's another thing that I had to learn, is that there has to be this really individually tailored balance for my students where I offer them support, but I also challenge them. I also make sure that they are staying in the path that they want to stay in, that they're not, you know, letting themselves be influenced by social groups or their ideas of what it means to be successful at UF. I want to challenge them to be true to themselves and what they want to do, because a lot of the times UF can pull you in 50 different directions. And I think my job is to be a mirror to my students and hold the mirror up to them and remind them of who they are, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's been both. It's been support, but also it's been really learning how to challenge them in a way that's appropriate and appropriate for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if I may, I think that understanding as to how someone who works within student affairs must handle or communicate with their students, right? Not only be someone who listens to their concerns, but also engages them and guides them in a certain direction, right? I think having that back and forth relationship is very useful for a lot of students, and I think it's manifested very much so in your position and your work in Gatorship. So do you believe that, I mean, for those of you, for those who are unaware of what gatorship is, would you mind explaining what it is and how you feel that you've been able to extend that the ideology into the space that is gatorship here?
Yeah, definitely. So gatorship is a social justice retreat at the University of Florida that is a peer facilitated retreat where we have a lot of dialogues around identity and a lot of activities that help students explore their different identities. So that means, you know, gender, sexuality, race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, etc. And I serve as an advisor to this program where we train gatorship staff to facilitate those retreats.
Right. And do you feel as if, you know, within gatorship, the students learn to, you know, in my experiences, be vulnerable and allow themselves to express their feelings as to their experiences being marginalized within this country as well as in this university, but also give those students the tools needed to confront those difficulties when they come back to the University of Florida. Do you believe that that's an accurate depiction as to what gatorship does succinctly, or did you feel like it's a little bit more than that and expand where you feel necessary? Yeah.
Well, so I believe that where gatorship really succeeds is in, again, sort of doing that, holding that mirror up to students and really allowing them to talk about their personal experiences and really learn through the listening to other people's personal experiences that they're not alone, right? Because a lot of the times we feel that our experiences of marginalization and oppression or isolated incidents, they're our own personal problems. But when we hear other students share their experiences with racism, their experiences with marginalization, to find out that you are not alone in that really makes you not just, you know, validate your own experiences, but it also makes you think of things systematically. Mm-hmm. So if it's not just my problem, if it's this entire group of people's problem, they've all had this similar problem, then we can start talking about systems. So what? How does systematic racism show up? How does systematic misogyny show up? How are people kept out of opportunities because of their class background? Or their different ability. And so I think it's both a way for students to explore themselves, but also to think of their lives, not just as this individual journeys, as lives that are connected to a larger system. And I think my hope is that it can also start to build solidarity because, you know, you also hear from experiences that are unlike your own. But I think that it can really start building solidarity and empathy to hear students speak openly about types of marginalizations that you haven't experienced. And so I think that gatorship is sort of like an opening. It's a little spark for students who haven't had the space to have candid conversations about issues of identity and marginalization and privilege. And my hope is that it really helps not just you know, helps people validate their experiences as a marginalized identity, but also it helps to shed some light on the privileges that we have, mm-hmm. because that's just as important, if not more important, to recognize.
Of course, yes. And so in terms of the benefits that a lot of students receive from gatorship, their attachment to the Student Affairs Department strengthens, right? This idea that the University of Florida can give you experiences where you do feel comfortable, even though you are entering a space that is radically different than what you may call home, right? Or what you do call home. So a lot of students look up to these programs such as Gatorship and the Multicultural and Diversity Affairs as beacons of light in their experiences here at the University of Florida. But recently, MCDA has been going through some restructuring, and that restructuring, I believe, led to your repositioning as Programs Director for Hispanic Latino Affairs to now Assistant Director of MCDA as a whole. So how do you feel like this restructuring has allowed you to now serve more students and help more students feel empowered here, you know, as in their time as a student?
So yeah, this opportunity of working for Multicultural Diversity Affairs as a whole, I think it really does parallel sort of like my journey from being centered around my own identity as Hispanic Latina to really expand into serving other marginalized identities. And I think I'm really grateful for it, because I think that once you are successful in exploring your own identity, it becomes so much easier to understand how you're connected to other oppressed or marginalized communities. And I think, again, going back to the idea of solidarity, I know that Hispanic Latino students are not going to be free, are not going to be fully integrated and fully appreciated and celebrated if Black students, if LGBTQ students, if Asian American Pacific Islander students are not also fully integrated within our institution. Maybe I don't want to use the word integrated because it sounds like assimilation, right? But maybe I want to say really fully empowered in this institution. And so I think that this new position gives me the chance to serve students in a way that is intersectional, in a way that is really attached to the larger goal of liberation for all marginalized communities, which is really where the core of social justice work should be. That should be the goal. And as somebody who considers myself a social justice educator, social justice practitioner, I think it's honestly a sort of a natural progression of my role here. So I'm really excited to work in that capacity.
Yeah, of course, of course. And, you know, I think for those who do work with MCDA and with the other departments within MCDA, having complete emancipation and full citizenship for all marginalized students within the University of Florida is of the utmost importance. And, you know, I would just want to continue to ask, what is now your vision as assistant director, and how has that changed from working with HLA? You know, you point to the fact that now you're not only focusing on one community, but all the communities within MCDA. And having this much more extensive role is allowing you to serve many more students. Obviously, as you pointed out with your vision as a programs coordinator, there was a learning curve, and there were things that were difficult to perform because it was a new position, and this is also a new position. So, I mean, what can you see yourself doing in the future, if you can even speak to that?
Yeah, well, I think that if I could, you know, envision an MCDA that really operates and serves students the way that I think they deserve to be served, I would really envision us providing not only educational opportunities, but really involvement opportunities for students of all identities to not just learn and empower themselves regarding their own communities, but also learn about intersectional issues, right? And I think that we do offer some of that programming now, but I think that it can be sort of like an offshoot of, like, you know, one event here, another event there. There's really not like a larger curricula that we now offer that can speak to those needs in a way that's progressive, in a way that's that builds upon itself. And I think that I would really love for us to integrate some of the skills that our students learn in leadership, so facilitated dialogue and conversations around identity with our ambassador program, and really have intersectional education and cross-cultural education for all of our communities that we serve. And I also think that it's imperative for us to expand our offices to serve Native American students, to serve our undocumented students in a more official capacity. Mm-hmm. I would also really like for us to do more interfaith work and really do the work of helping bridge those differences in different faith communities. So there's a lot. There's a lot of goals there, but I think at the core of those goals is really having an unapologetic and really present, visible MCDA that works at the core of these issues and really is sort of pushing the envelope. I think that that's really our role as a department that serves underrepresented students. I think our role is to push the envelope and to challenge our university to include us in every part of the university, from academic curricula to leadership roles in student organizations and others.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, personally, I would like the Multicultural University Affairs to continue pushing the envelope. And if there's anything that you would like to add as to this interview as a whole, I mean, this is your moment to add that. And would you have something to add?
I guess for me, I would add sort of on a note of just understanding where we are in the political climate to kind of give a little context to this conversation, because, we're in the second, third month of the Trump presidency, and we are in a state of transition for the department as a whole. So I think we are really in a place of it's a place of discomfort and a place of a lot of instability. But I really would want for us to look back and see this also as a space of opportunity, because I think that a lot of the times in crises is where you really step up and can change an organization to the place where it could go. And I really hope that that's what we do here. That's certainly something that I'm going to hopefully be part of.
Right. Of course. If that's it, then, on behalf of the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program, I would thank you for sitting down with me for this hour and 6 minute interview. And I really appreciate everything you have to say, Deanna, and we really hope to see you do great things moving forward.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.